No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show, which must attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I hope my show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important and affect the lives of all of us. Today, I'm just so excited to have a very special person, Marianne Williamson, who happens to be a candidate for president again, and we're going to talk about that. But if you don't know who Marianne is, I assume you live under a rock, because she's a best-selling author, political activist, a global influencer and thought leader. She's written more than 15 books, and she's got four of them on the New York Times bestseller list. And we're excited to have you with us today. Marianne, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you so much, Senator Brown. It is always lovely to talk to you.
Well, let's start at the beginning. Why are you doing this? You halted your campaign, and now you've reinstituted it for to run for president in the Democratic primary. So, why? What's your motivation? What's changed?
Well, I'm looking at what's happening in this country, and like millions of people, I'm deeply disturbed. You have 39% of Americans who now say that they regularly skip meals in order to pay their rent. Over half of our bankruptcies are medical bankruptcies due to the fact that one in four Americans live with medical debt. The majority of Americans live paycheck to paycheck, can't absorb a $400 unexpected expenditure. We have people, 70% of Americans, who say they live with chronic economic anxiety. And our political establishment doesn't even seem to register that this level of human despair is happening. We have a middle class that has completely collapsed. You know, I remember an America in the 1970s that was a thriving middle class, when the average American couple could afford a house and a car and a yearly vacation. They could afford to send their kids to college. One salary could support a family of four. And we have had such a radical $50 trillion transfer of wealth from the bottom 90% of Americans that we're no longer a thriving democracy. And when you're not a thriving, when you're not a thriving middle class, you're not a thriving democracy, and we're not one. We know that. This is what's so strange to me, Senator. Everybody knows this. I'm not saying anything people don't know. And you should theoretically be able to look at your political parties. You should be able to look at your political candidates to acknowledge the truth and seek to do something about it. And we now have a political establishment that gains power and perpetuates its power by not looking at the deeper reality that most Americans experience. And they promise that they will, and then they don't. And if they won't, then I will. And that's why I'm running.
Well, you know what? I got to tell you, Marianne, win, lose, or draw, I believe that the things you say, that you have a very important voice. And I think that these things actually need to be said, and that I agree with you. Not enough people are saying them. You know, it seems to me, you and I are approximately the same age, and it seems to me that I remember those times from the 1970s as well. And it's not that we didn't have controversy in those times, but it seems to me that we've turned from people in politics that care about America to people in politics that only care about staying in power. They only care about, you know, whatever they can do. We have Democrats. We have a Democrat in California who's supporting the Republican candidate because he thinks he'll be a weaker challenger in the Democratic in the general election. That is the height of cynicism to me. Had the Democratic Party do that in the last election. They put literally hundreds of thousands of dollars into campaigns of what they considered weak Republicans because they really didn't care what the issues were anymore. They all only cared about winning. So I think everything you're saying is so important and needs to be said. But you got to admit it's going to be an uphill battle. Now, yesterday
Everything you're saying is true, and the two major political parties are basically owned by private equity firms at this point. The word oligarchy is apt. We are not a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. Not right now. That vision is, you know, when Abraham Lincoln coined that phrase, he said that the people who died for the North at the Battle of Gettysburg had died so that a government of the people, by the people, and for the people would not perish from the earth. But it's perishing now. It's perishing on our watch. We're a government of the corporations, by the corporations, for the corporations, of the billionaires, by the billionaires, and for the billionaires. And this is, this, you know, we can't even look at this like an uphill battle. It's the battle to save our democracy. And, you know, the Democratic Party would argue that we need to elect President Biden in order to save our democracy. But I have to tell you, even though I do think that Donald Trump is a threat to our democracy, please don't get me wrong, but I'm speaking to you from the belly of the beast, and my experience running over the last year has been one in which the Democratic Party establishment suppressed democracy in order, in their minds, to save democracy. And so we're at a point now where we have to face the entire establishment. I think personally, in order to save democracy, we're going to have to save the Democratic Party. We have to retrieve the soul of the Democratic Party in order to retrieve the soul of this country.
Well, I agree with that too. And I am a democracy suppressor because I'm a superdelegate. And you know, when I was at the Democratic Committee, we came up with the idea of the superdelegate. And people on staff thought it was ridiculous. We thought it was horrible. We thought, well, what a ridiculous idea to put these people in that are going to make sure that whoever the incumbent is gets reelected. But then we went, then time passed, and we all forgot about it because it never came to play. Superdelegates never meant anything for 20 years until they did, right? And now they're a big deal again. So I'm going to be a super delegate again, Marianne. Why should I vote for you?
Well, first of all, thank you very much. I mean, that is actually a very big deal. I would be deeply grateful, Senator, for your support, your being a super delegate. There is no should here involved here, but I think that you know what I stand for. I stand for an economic bill of rights, an economic U-turn, universal medical, you know, Medicare for all, universal health care, a complete eradication of the college loan debt through the Higher Education Act, paid family leave, subsidized child care, tuition-free college and tech school, guaranteed housing, guaranteed sick pay, guaranteed living wage, a Department of Peace so that we can be as sophisticated and strategic in efforts to wage peace as to wage war if we need to. We need a ceasefire now. We need to ramp down rather than to continue to ramp up fossil fuel extraction. We need to end America's war on drugs, and we need a Department of Children and Youth. The only should here is if you agree with the things I just said, and they align with your heart, I would request, with deep humility, and I would be so honored if you would be willing to support me, because that's where the power lies. The power that you hold in your hands is, in fact, where the power lies.
Well, let me ask you about a couple of these issues specifically. I really don't understand. Maybe you can explain it to me a little bit. Why there are so many countries that have universal health care, and we don't seem to be able to do that. We don't seem to be able to, you know, and I'm not talking about just socialist democracies like in Northern Europe, but also countries like Canada. So why can't we do that? Why can't we wrap our heads around that idea?
I think we need to stop saying we can't and admit to ourselves that our elected representatives don't choose to. President Biden has said that he would veto a Medicare for All bill, and we know why. It is because of the institutionalized greed of the insurance companies. And the insurance companies like Big Pharma, like Big Food, like Big Ag, like big chemical companies, like big gun manufacturers, like Big Oil, and like defense contractors, hold Washington hostage. Washington is like a system of legalized bribery, isn't it? So it's not that it's complicated or that we can't. It's that the situation is so corrupt. We absolutely have to break the power, break our cord that ties us to the insurance companies, the private insurance companies, which are wreaking havoc in people's lives. One in four Americans live with medical debt. 18 million Americans cannot afford the prescriptions that their doctors give them. 68,000 Americans die every year from lack of health care. 75 to 90 million Americans are either uninsured or underinsured. You know, underinsurance, as I'm sure you know, Senator, there are millions of Americans who do have the insurance to cover the doctor's visit, but it doesn't cover the pills that the doctor wants to prescribe, the tests that the doctors want to prescribe, or the surgery that the doctor wants to prescribe. So when you say we can't, we need to remember to remind people, no, it's so corrupt. They don't choose to, because they are paid off in their own way by the insurance companies. And that is exactly why we, the people, need to step in. And you're right. Not only, and it's two things. Not only is it, as you said, that every other advanced democracy has universal health care, just like every other advanced democracy and other advanced nations have tuition-free college and tech school. There's something even, to me, more significant than that. The majority of Republicans as well as Democrats, not as much of a majority, but a majority of Republicans as well as Democrats want Medicare for all. Just as a majority of Republicans as well as Democrats want tuition-free college and tech school. And that is exactly why the Democratic establishment elite has not wanted me in the conversation. That's why they have gotten me blacklisted this entire year on CNN, and I was blacklisted this entire year on MSNBC, because they know, even though they like to say I'm not a serious candidate, they know how serious I am. That's why they say I'm unserious, because they know how serious I am. And they know that if the kind of agenda that I'm speaking about were really heard by the American people, we would start a political bonfire.
Yeah, I think that I'm sorry to hear that about CNN, because I remember when you really were, people were making a joke of you on Saturday Night Live and other stuff. And then you were in the debates, and all of a sudden, I'm proud to say you were on Shadow Politics before that, but then you were on the debates and all of a sudden you were on CNN. You were people started to take you seriously because mm-hmm. they started to listen to what you had to say rather than see you as some kind of pop culture diva, you know, to realize that you're more than that you really are deeply concerned. Can I ask you one other thing? It's just, this is what really bothers me. It really bothers me that we buy into this, that I turn on the TV in the morning and I see Texas on fire and I see 10 feet of snow in California and I went to Nebraska to testify before the Senate last week and the temperature was 65 degrees, even though they have 30 below sometimes in the wintertime. And then we have a presidential candidate that says what we need to do is drill more, burn more fossil fuel, and we've got half of America behind him. Why do we buy into this? All you have to do is open the door and go outside to realize that climate change is a calamity, right?
Well, yes, but let's go deeper into that. You're right. Why do so many millions of Americans buy it when a presidential candidate says that climate change is a hoax? But also, why do we buy it when the other major presidential candidate, namely the president himself, claims to see the problem, but in reality has given more oil drilling permits than even Trump did? In the modern era, whether they're Democrats or Republicans presidents, they line up with fossil fuel companies. So why do we buy that? And why do we buy that ridiculous narrative of what you call the pop diva? You're right. Why are people so easily manipulated? Why are people so, why are the Democratic voters these days lining up like lemons to the sea? You know, the president has not been out among the people. He doesn't go out among the people. He doesn't seem to demonstrate knowledge of what the average American is actually going through. His handlers keep real people away from him. And millions of us are registering that he does not demonstrate either the mental or the physical vitality that is necessary to take on Donald Trump. We are just watching a slow motion car crash here. And we have got to stand up to it. We have got to.
Well, that is a really terrible problem that the Democrats have right now. I like Joe Biden. I think he's an honest man. I've supported him. But I got to say, age is a real issue. Now, it's not as much an issue for me personally, because I know a lot of old people that are very, very wise. But I look at people like my daughter. My daughters are both concerned about his age. There are lots of people that are concerned, not only because they worry about his capacity, but also, you know, you are trapped certainly in the framework in which you exist, right? So there's a lot of my kids call me old school all the time. They go, "Oh, Dad, that's you know, you're so old," you know, because I have a mindset that was developed in the 1960s and 70s and 80s, and I still see the world through that lens. And I think that's a problem for my kids, for example, who are now in their late 20s and 30s, and in 30s. They worry about his mindset, how he sees the world. And I think that is a real, real problem for us. But I don't know what we do about it.
What we can do about it is elect someone else. Hello, me. And even though I am not going to win the presidency, given the current trajectory, a vote for me is a vote for me to be in the conversation. And if the things you and I are talking about here are not in the conversation, we will lose to Donald Trump. Now, it's not just Joe Biden. It's the entire political establishment is stuck in the thinking of the 20th century, just as your kids have said. And the thinking of the 20th century was very mechanistic. And it was seeing the world as a big machine. If something's not okay, just simply tweak the pieces of the machine. That means you're always looking at symptoms, but you're never addressing root cause. And my campaign has been all about healing root causes. And that's in line with the thinking of the 21st century. The 21st century is much more holistic, much more whole person, recognizing that what's going on inside people has political consequences. Obviously, look at terrorism. It's hatred turned into a political force. Psychological and emotional issues are extremely important in determining people's political behavior. So when our young people don't understand and can't align with someone whose thinking is stuck in the 20th century, it's for good reason, particularly economically. Young people do not understand why they should live their lives at the effect of bad ideas left over from the 20th century, particularly economic ones, and I agree with them.
Well, I do too, and I got to tell you, the one thing, you know, when I talk to my kids, their outlook on the world and what they want in life is so different than where we were, you know. My kids aren't worried about buying a home. I have a daughter that lives in Chicago, doesn't even own a car. She wants to travel around the world. She wants to interact with people. She puts experiences above, you know, personal wealth or comfort or anything else. And she, and her outlook on the world is totally different. And the world has changed so much. You know, I say things to my kids, Marianne, like, oh, I got my first job by looking in the newspaper when I graduated from college, which is true. And they laugh at that. They go, Dad, that's not how it's done anymore. I've submitted 175 resumes with Google search or whatever and haven't even gotten a response. The world has changed so dramatically. And but we keep on buying into this. You know, I sit here and I rail against people like Amazon and Walmart. But you know what? I go into Walmart and I shop when I need something. And I feel guilty about it. I try to deal with small vendors, but we all buy into it a little bit. So how do we change those mindsets of the people? Because that really bothers me that we have 50% of the population, so maybe even more, unfortunately, supporting this man that's absolutely out of his mind. He's crazy, you know? And right now he's in the lead for to become the next president of the United States. It's really, really concerning. So what can we do to change the mindset of the people? We have to do that, right?
Well, no, I don't think we're going to change the mindset of the Trump voters. Those people are going to vote for Trump no matter what, and that's their right. I think our bigger electoral danger is not people voting for Trump. It's people staying home. Yeah. And so I think, younger people, like your own children, they don't relate to Joe Biden either.
Yeah,
they don't relate to anyone who represents the old, and they're not going to go vote for Trump. But the danger is that they will just stay home. The Democrats will lose in 2024 unless we give something, unless we offer to people a chance to better their lives. What is Joe Biden offering? What name one issue that he's saying to people, I will do this in the next 4 years. He's saying, I will finish the job to people who viscerally do not have any benefit that has come into their lives in the last 4 years compared to the 4 years before that. I mean, for him to say the economy is doing well, it's not doing well for the majority of people. It's doing well for 20% of us. So I don't think we need to change the mindset of the Trump voter so much as we need to ask ourselves about our own mindset. When I look at all those people who have voted for Biden in this primary season, having had the wool just pulled over their eyes by the Democratic establishment, who, in my own experience, I can tell you, did everything possible to suppress democracy in this race, kicking me off ballots, blocking my appearances places, making sure I would be blacklisted from major media platforms that were necessary in order for people to know I even existed. This is a threat to our democracy that is not just embodied by Donald Trump. So I think the mindset we need to look at is our own. Are we really going to go along with this? Because if we do, we're going to have a very, very difficult time beating Donald Trump in 2024.
Well, the point that you make about people staying home is really, really important, because that's how he won the first time. He, you know, black people stayed home more than normal. Women stayed home more than normal. And that's what that if they had come to the polls as usual, it's very likely that Trump wouldn't have won to begin with. So that's very, very true. And you know, it's true. We're at this point where all we want to do is win. And our platform right now, as far as I can see it, as a Democrat, as a loyal Democrat, is that we're not Donald Trump. And I don't think that's enough. I agree with you.
That's
I don't think
exactly
it's enough.
Exactly right.
I don't think it's enough to go out there and say, you know, if you don't vote for me, you're going to get this horrible, horrible person. As true as that may be, I think we need to put something more out there. I do.
Well, also, Senator, what you just said, you said all we want is to win. If all we wanted was to win, then the DNC would have allowed a real primary. If all you want to do is to win, then you have a primary and you let everyone who is running and who wants to run and who has a qualified candidate, FEC registered, We should have all had the opportunity, myself, Dean Phillips, anyone else who wanted to run. We should have had a robust primary so that the Democratic voters could have decided what it's going to take to beat Donald Trump. But instead, the candidates, anyone but Joe Biden, were completely suppressed. And we did not have a real primary season. We did not have a robust conversation. And so what has happened over the last, you know, few weeks with these primary races are just the, you know, the unfolding that was manipulated by the DNC. It's something for us to wake up to right now, so that we can have a robust voice at the Democratic convention, so that perhaps we can influence the platform, perhaps we can influence the president himself. Because if we just continue to acquiesce to the situation that the DNC has determined and has manipulated, I think we're going to have a very difficult time in 2024. And then I think the country is going to have a very difficult time in the years beyond that.
Well, you know, I was at the last brokered convention. I've been to every Democratic convention since 1980. And in 1980, there was an attempt by Ted Kennedy to take the nomination away from Jimmy Carter. In response to that, we had several bad years with people like Dukakis and Mondale, and they came up with this idea of the superdelegate. And for our listeners who might not know what the superdelegate is, a superdelegate is gets that designation by virtue of either his elected office or what we call a party influencer. So, you know, somebody that has great influence in the party. So they're all political insiders. And I think the last time I looked, there were about 1,200 of us. So you've got the nomination. It's almost impossible to take the nomination away from the incumbent. It would be almost impossible given the fact that he's got these people before the start of the primary. And you're right. You know, the whole time that Bernie Sanders was out there complaining about how he'd been boxed out of things and how he had been, you know, the party had closed him out of, you know, having a legitimate open primary with where he could discuss his ideas and stuff. He was absolutely right. I mean, I went for Hillary Clinton. I supported Hillary Clinton, but Bernie was right. He was shut out. And to be honest with you, Marianne, the idea of the superdelegate was to make sure that candidates like you couldn't come in and you know, get the nomination.
That's exactly right.
A dark horse candidate couldn't emerge from the pack and get
Exactly right. So the Democratic Party has become an exclusive private club, and it is directed by private equity firms. And that's where this is the opposite of democracy. I mean, when you talk about so that somebody outside their club wouldn't be able to come in, my God, we say we believe in the Constitution. Our country was not founded to be directed by a political class. That's just a reformation of an aristocracy. That's all that is.
Well,
and that aristocracy represents the interests of the matrix of corporate powers that I mentioned before. We're not of the people, by the people, and for the people anymore. We're of the corporations, by the corporations, and for the corporations. And if we don't stand up to that, then everything that this country was founded to be is, like I said, perishing on our watch.
Well, and you know, one thing we could do, you know, in my humble opinion, the thing that we could do that would most improve politics would be to get the money out of it, to have federally funded elections and not have these guys feel like they constantly have to pander, especially the members of Congress who finish, get elected, and 2 days later open up a fundraising apparatus. And I got to tell you, Marianne, you know, you've run for political office, you've had to raise money. If somebody gives you $50,000, when they call, you're going to answer the phone. It's not a matter of, right? These people have incredible influence by giving money, because money is the lifeblood of politics. And in my opinion, if you could get that out of politics, you'd go a long way in reforming the system.
Well, there's no doubt about it. The undue influence of money on our politics is the cancer underlying all the other cancers. And your children and mine, I think it will be their generation, to ultimately establish a constitutional amendment to provide federal funding for, public funding for federal campaigns. Mm. The problem right now, however, is that we don't have such an amendment right now. And the only thing that can override the nefarious influence of those moneyed forces is a peaceful revolution at the ballot box and the kind of things that you and I are talking about here. Anything that we can do to make noise, to refuse to go along, and to stand for a Democratic Party that has returned to its principles. Principles of unequivocal advocacy for the working people of the United States.
Well, that's true, too. I mean, I often say that I was born a Democrat. I was an orphan who dropped out of high school, had to work my way back into college and graduate school. The first decent paycheck, started working full time when I was 14. First decent paycheck I ever got was as a Teamster. So, you know, that's what the Democratic Party used to stand for. They used to stand for working class people. They used to stand for people that were members of unions. They used to stand for those. And that's another thing that amazes me, Marianne, that you can have a guy that's a billionaire who's never worked a decent day in his life convince working class people that he understands who they are and where they come from. I mean, it's just absolutely incredible to me. But let's talk about some practical issues here. By my count, you've gotten close to 250,000 votes. You've gotten 222,591 votes.
That's right.
And you've come in second in Arkansas, California, Oklahoma, South Carolina, Tennessee, Utah, Vermont, and Virginia. And among those states, I mean, Oklahoma, you did the best in Oklahoma. Did you campaign a lot there? I mean, that's
a surprise. No, I haven't been there, but I'm so grateful. I do come from Texas, you know, so I have a little bit of the Annie Oakley in me, you know.
Well, and that's a good thing,
maybe,
right?
They just recognize my personality. And I do have some friends in Oklahoma, so... I'm very grateful to Oklahoma.
Well, I have some friends too. I've done some work with Native Americans, and I have some friends in Oklahoma as well. But Virginia and South Carolina, those are critical states. Texas. I don't think the Democrats. I can't remember the last time Democrats won Texas or Utah, but certainly California, Virginia, South Carolina, these are major, major states. So let me ask you, are you developing any kind of convention strategy that is there a chance that you will develop a strategy to go into the convention with delegates?
Well, the best strategy I have is with people like yourself. I have two people who are superdelegates who have been willing, who are standing up for me. You know, one of the things that is happening is this uncommitted campaign. And I am a Ceasefire Now candidate. And we are requesting that people who are uncommitted delegates will take a look at my my candidacy and see me as an ally. I am certainly the only one running who has made a stand for Ceasefire Now, even before the bombing began. So other than that, what I'm planning to do is to stay in. I'm in Washington right now. I'm in Seattle. Then I will be going to Georgia, and I will stay in. It is reasonable to assume that the president will kind of get this thing locked up next week, but anything I can do to get more votes and possibly receive delegates somewhere. If I can receive delegates anywhere in a way that will then take me to the convention and then have people such as yourself, people who are delegates, people who are superdelegates, it's difficult because so many of the delegates are by definition people who are there because they support support Joe Biden. But Senator, I can't stop at this point. It just feels so wrong not to have a voice in the mix who even mentions the poor, who even mentions poverty, who even mentions hunger, who even mentions lack of health care, who even mentions ceasefire now. And we can't do this. We have to we have to be willing to make a statement for the angels of our better nature. We just have to. At least that's how I feel, and I am hoping for any allies who join with me and feel as I do, that a stand for actual democracy, a stand for the betterment of the American people and the people of the world and the repair of the earth is the voice that absolutely must be heard.
Well, yeah, it does absolutely have to be heard. And you're right. The fix is in. We're so concerned about winning that we're afraid, you know, that we're motivated primarily by fear, I think. You're afraid to annoy, you know, the perfect political position, I think, is that you believe in a person's right to have a gun, but you also believe in gun control. You talk out of both sides of your mouth, and in the end, nothing gets accomplished, right? That's another problem that we have. We have, you know, in Washington, D.C., I know you live here at least part-time, and you understand the crime problem we're having. We have 14-year-olds shooting each other on the street. We have congressmen being carjacked. We have another congresswoman who was attacked in her apartment building. I mean, we had an NFL running back who was shot 3 times by a 14-year-old on U Street to have his car stolen. I mean, we need in D.C. at least, and I think throughout the country, we need to get guns off the street. And also, you know, you and I both grew up in a society that had a lot of guns. I never heard of a mass shooting. There was one mass shooting when I was young at a university in Texas, and you know, guy in a bell tower. But that was.
Oh, I remember that. I remember that.
And how many do we have now? We have more mass shootings this year than we have days so far. I mean, so there's something that's changing in our mentality too, that we really need to address. But if you go to the convention, have you taken any solace from what Nikki Haley has done? Nikki Haley has gotten more than 2 million votes. She got close to 3 million votes. Do you think, does that say that people are reaching out for change on both sides? Do you think
well,
there's a way,
you know,
to bring people together?
Until today, I had a lot of respect for her grit, the way she was staying in. And, you know, today she dropped out, which is fine. But then she endorsed Trump. You know, she's. In the final analysis, she's a player. She's a good soldier.
Yeah.
If she really believed all the things that she said about Donald Trump, you know. But then on the other hand, she stopped short of calling him, you know, the danger to our democracy that I think she knows he is, because she wants to, you know, live to fight another day and maybe be the nominee next time.
Yep,
they're
exactly.
All part of the same system in the final analysis, and I'm just not part of that system. And most Americans aren't part of that system. And so that system projects onto any of us who don't play along that we're weird, but really they're weird.
Right, exactly.
They project onto us that we're fringe. Really, they're fringe. And when you said before, you know, so rightfully, you know, that they picture me as a pop diva, they're the one who's just a pop culture phenomenon. They have nothing to do with the deeper waters of democracy.
Well, and you know, my wife felt the same way about Nikki Haley. She not that she particularly supported her, but she thought, yeah, I admire her for grit. I admire her for staying in. But you're right. In the final analysis, you know, much like our buddy Mitch McConnell, you know, Donald Trump attacked his wife. And you know, said racially insensitive things about his wife. I can't imagine that there was anything a candidate could do to get me to endorse him after him or her after he had said something like that about
my
wife.
But they are.
Yep, they do.
It's unbelievable.
And it's the old saying in the Democratic Party, you know, that Democrats fall in love and Republicans fall in line. And, yeah, we see that. And it's troubling. I guess I feel sympathy for people that support Trump that want to, so desperate for change that they want to throw, you know, their shoes into the machinery, you know, right? Their sabot into the machines and cause sabotage. But it's the educated people that really get me. I know many well-educated people that support Donald Trump. That I don't get at all. But anyway, that's another subject altogether. So are there other candidates that you could support? In other words, if you get build up some momentum, do you think, first of all, do you think other candidates will come forth now? Or it's
you mean
just
in
locked
the Republican
up
Party or in the Democratic
no,
Party?
No, in the Democratic Party.
No, no other candidates are going to come forth now. So the issue is, are we going to keep going, work in these states where that still have primaries, hopefully get some delegates and be able to go into the convention and have an influence on the conversation that the Democratic Party is having in 2024. That's the goal now. What are the Democrats offering now except be afraid, be very, very afraid? That is not going to win in 24. That might have won in 2020 to a large extent, but it's different now. Too many people have had it. Too many people are hopeless, are feeling hopeless, are feeling like the situation is locked up. You know, the president has gotten, roughly 6 million votes in the primary season so far. That's not nearly enough to win the presidency. So this sort of inside game that the Democrats play with themselves, that's not going to win the presidency. We're only going to win the presidency if we are a party that people feel has their back.
Right.
And the Democratic Party today has the back of 20% of the American people.
That's right. You know, that they've lost so many of the traditional groups that were part of the Democratic coalition when I started 40 years ago. Like organized
Absolutely.
Labor. I mean, they still have the support of organized labor, but they don't have the rank and file support. You know,
the Teamsters
may come out and endorse them, but then a lot of them don't follow the, you know, back in the day. It was a much more of a coalition, a cohesive coalition. So is there anything we can do outside, assuming that here we are, Joe Biden's going to be the nominee. We're going to work hard for him because we don't want Donald Trump to win. But is there anything we can do to strengthen that coalition, to bring people back into the party outside the apparatus that now exists through, you know, let me tell you, some of the things that you're saying resonate with me because the Democratic Party took statehood, which is my big issue, out of their platform. And they wouldn't put it back in the platform. This was in North Carolina at the convention. So what I did was I went out and I spent my own money. I spent $20,000 to put two gigantic billboards outside the convention center about supporting statehood, and then embarrass them. And in the next, convention, statehood was back in the platform. So I really believe in trying to work outside the box to get things done when you can't get things done from the inside. So what can we do to work outside the box? What can we do at the convention? What can we do?
Well, I'd love to have further conversation with you, Senator. And of course, with you, you also have power on the inside as well. So I would love to brainstorm with you about that. I think all of your listeners would agree with us that it's going to have to be an inside and outside approach.
Yeah.
And as someone who has been in the primary, as someone who will hopefully I will be working on getting more delegates, you yourself as a delegate, our presence, our, you know, using our voices. Like I said, I'd love to talk to you further about that because I believe that the yearnings and the hopes of the American people are with us. They're a wind at the back of anyone who is willing to stand up and lay claim to a vision of our democracy in which people really do have the capacity to soar. That's the whole point of all this. That's the American dream. when we have carcinogens in our food that they don't have in other advanced democracies, simply because of the power of big ag and big chemical companies and big food companies. Meanwhile, we have the highest rate of chronic illness of any other advanced democracy or even advanced country. So it's bigger than just whether or not we have health care. It's whether or not we have policies that proactively help us be a healthier society. When people know all this, when people know that 46% of our urban water wells are filled with those PFAS, when people are living in communities where there are such toxins spewed into the air that their children have a higher rate of asthma, but they can't even afford the inhalers, the American people are beyond frustrated. They're enraged. They are depressed. And I think those of us who are willing to simply make ourselves available to ideas for how to help, if we put our heads and our hearts together, I think we will come up with those things. And I look forward to talking to you further about that, if you're willing.
Oh, always willing to talk to you, Marianne. Like I said to you before the show, you're one of the smartest people I've ever met. You know, when you sit in a room with somebody and you talk to them for a while, somebody that really has a deep intellect, it jumps right off the page at you. You know, there are people, and look, I'm a smart guy. I'm street smart. I'm a quick study. But I recognize when people really have a profound intellect, and you certainly have that, Marianne. And I think that's another reason why I think your voice is so important. Even if you don't get elected, I think to have you out there, you know, I think of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who's a woman that I often disagree with, but I so much want her in Congress. I so much appreciate what she does because I think she speaks from her heart and I think she represents people and I think she's an important voice. Even if she's not the majority voice, I think we need to have people that are always in there trying to tell the truth and trying to create a debate with inside the party, because that's how we get to the right positions, I believe. So let me ask you, Marianne, we're running out of time here. We've got about 8 or 9 minutes left. What do you want to say that I haven't asked you? What's the most important? I train candidates on occasion, and one thing that we always do is we give them a stump speech, right? We say, you got to have a stump speech in your pocket. Every time you go to an event or, you know, somebody calls you up to the stage, you got to have a stump speech. So what's your stump speech?
Well, I think a lot of what I talk about in a stump speech we have covered here, but I would like an opportunity to focus in a little bit on this idea of a Department of Peace.
Yeah, please.
In medicine, we've learned that we need to do more than be able to treat disease. We have to learn how to prevent illness to begin with. We need to proactively cultivate healthier bodies. And I think we need to look at the society that way. And a Department of Peace would be one in which we had a peace academy, just like we have a military academy. We play peace games, just like we play war games, where we have armies of peace builders, just like we have armies of military personnel. And I think a lot of people might not realize that peace building is an actual thing. And there are four factors which, when present, and this could be in a corner of an American city, such as Washington, D.C. And I'm speaking now directly to what you were talking about before, about the conditions in our city. This could be in a city in America or anywhere else in the world. There are four factors which, when present, statistically indicate that there will be a higher incidence of peace and a lower incidence of violence. Number one, greater economic opportunities for women. Number two, greater educational opportunities for children. Number three, a reduction of violence against women. And number four, a reduction in unnecessary human despair. And I think if you apply that, even that thinking, how do we prevent war? How do we create peace? JFK said we will either put an end to war or war will put an end to us. So my policies represent a fundamental break with the past. We can't just take these incremental approaches to trying to tweak things here and tweak things there. We have to be a generation that says there's going to be fundamental change. Just like the abolitionists responded to slavery, just like the women's suffragists responded to the institutional suppression of women, just like the early labor organizers responded to the Gilded Age, and just like the civil rights movement responded to segregation, it's our turn now. It's our turn to say something is fundamentally wrong, it is fundamentally unjust, it is fundamentally undemocratic and economic way of thinking in which short-term profits for huge corporations is placed before the safety, health, and well-being of the American people has formed a new status quo. And it is a corrupt status quo, and it will not change itself. And we, the people, need to intervene now. And that's what my candidacy stands for. And I welcome the help of anyone who wants to say, yeah, let's do this. My website is marianne2024.com. The DC primary has not taken place yet. I hope that you and your listeners will be open to further relationship with me so that we can try to help save our country.
Well, first of all, let me tell you, some of your trans candidates, that's one hell of a stump speech. It's very, very good. But let me also ask you, are you on the ballot in D.C.? Are you on the ballot
Absolutely.
In many other states? Yeah,
Absolutely.
And you're on the ballot
on the
most
we're on
other
the ballot
states?
In 40 states.
Oh, you are? That's great.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And, yeah, because we, I don't know what, I guess the next primary, Hawaii's today.
And, yeah, Hawaii's today.
And then the only one, other one in March, I think, is Arizona, Georgia, Illinois, a lot of big ones.
Washington State, which is where I am now. Then I'll be flying to Georgia. We've got a lot still going on. Yeah.
Yeah, Ohio, those are all big things. So, Marianne Williamson, your heart is in the right place. I believe your head is in the right place too. And I'm so happy that you come and shared who you are with our listeners. I hope you come back again as things progress. And I hope that, you and I can sit down and have a drink in Chicago at the convention, because I hope you'll be there. And I hope that you'll be an important voice, because we really need to, make some changes. I agree with you. So thanks so much for being on the show. And you know what?
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, absolutely. And we always dedicate a song to the person that's been on the show. We close out with a song. And this is a song that makes me think of you, Marianne. It's called The Climb by Miley Cyrus. And it's about the effort more than the result. So best of luck to you, and I hope to talk to you again in the near future. Our listeners, we'll have another guest for you next week. And thanks for listening. And think
Thank
about
you.
Marianne. All right.
Thank
bye.
You very, very much.
Of course. See
bye.
You next week, folks.
Give the people their right to vote.